Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 26th of February, 2020. I really had to think about that. We're nearly at the end of February already, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Well, non-news. Let's start with some critical non-news, at least as far as the BBC is concerned. And if you take a look at their website today, the one thing that you can't see anything about is, of course, the ICSA child abuse report. So in the last couple of days, we've had information coming out from ICSA. It drifted across the BBC very, very briefly. It didn't get any prominence. And now, as we can see from the BBC's website, this is a non-subject. It doesn't really exist. And it's pointless looking to the BBC to protect children from abuse in UK.
Just to echo that, the Today programme this morning, it got the last 10 minutes of the programme. So this is the flagship news programme on BBC or on British media. Begins at 6 a.m. in the morning. So 3 hours of news in the morning, and the last 10 minutes was that.
Yeah, Radio 4 at 10 o'clock last night was talking about coronavirus. It was talking about Egypt. It was talking about a variety of other topics without a mention. So the BBC, true to form, not interested in getting to the bottom of the abuse of children in UK. Of course, itself culpable, guilty of covering up the Jimmy Savile episode. BBC is not going to talk about institutional child abuse and child abuse in Westminster. So how's the story progressed? Well, some of the media have talked about it, but what we've seen very, very clearly is that the whole emphasis has now moved across onto the Lib Dem peer, Lord Steele. He's implicated in as much as the evidence tends to indicate that he knew, but he didn't take the right action. He's now stepped down because he said, if I don't step down, then I've got both support and criticism within the party, and I don't want to cause internal problems. So I'm going to step down from the Lords and quietly retire. But what can we see? Well, the whole focus has now drifted across onto Lord Steele. We're not talking about the perpetrators of the child abuse. We're not talking about how that child abuse was covered up. But at least Sky News, in contrast to the BBC, did have something to say. It said that ICSA said MPs, including Smith and Speeder Morrison, were protected from prosecution. The report says there was a culture of failing to recognise abuse, turning a blind eye, covering up allegations, concluded that politicians valued reputation far higher than the fate of the children involved. Now, that last sentence there, Mike, says a lot about the quality of Britain's politicians. People could say, well, that was the situation as was. What we say as the UK column is that is the situation today. It continues. But let's see how the ICSA inquiry has actually reported on this. And of course, we need to bring in Baroness Jay. And let's have a look at some of the things that she said in her report. So this key one, MPs, including Smith and Sir Peter Morrison, were protected from prosecution. Remember all the other political names that have been mentioned over recent years in relation to child abuse? Well, they're not mentioned at all because this inquiry has been able to focus down on just one or two individuals as part of its downplaying of the whole process, but more on that in a minute. There was a culture of failing to recognise abuse, turning a blind eye to it, covering up allegations and actively protecting high profile offenders, including politicians within Westminster. That's a pretty interesting statement. Think about what she's saying there. Not only was the abuse going on, but people turned a blind eye to it. They covered up allegations and they actively protected high profile offenders. Now, in my mind, that means that we had an orchestrated system for protecting people abusing children. We had the abusers and we had the protected system. That to me sounds very much like a child abuse ring. But let's see what else she had to say. ICSA heard evidence that senior police officers thwarted the investigation into Smith because the case was too political. That sounds to me like a serious criminal activity by the police in order to protect the abusers of children, but it's just one line in the report. The evidence shows his party, so she's talking about the Conservatives here, made efforts to suppress these rumours rather than conduct a formal investigation. Sorry, that was Smith. This should be Lib Dems rather than Conservatives. These rumours, rather than conduct a formal investigation, the focus of attention remained unswervingly on political consequences rather than the welfare of the child. So this is being forced home, that the political party is more concerned about protecting children, more concerned about protecting their reputation than the children. And of course, this is the law on its head, because the duty of those political parties, probably more than the average individual, is to protect the children. She goes on, Peter Morrison was protected as a member of the establishment. Well, that's pretty clear cut. And that is repeated several times in the report. So I've put that up just to emphasise the constant focus on these two. They're the only thing that they talk about. And this statement is reported several times, and the reputation one is reported several times. So here we are. A consistent pattern emerged of failures to put the welfare of children above political status, although we found no evidence of an organised network of paedophiles within government. This is all good. But the report itself describes the actions of that very government paedophile network. There were active child abusers in Westminster. They were protected by powerful political and establishment figures. Plus, it's admitted that the CPS also helped to protect them, and the police helped to protect them. So, Mike, this is just a brilliant piece of whitewash, that you describe a paedophile ring operating in Westminster, and then you say it wasn't actually a paedophile ring.
But as well as that, if you look at the language, we find no evidence. Well, of course, if you don't speak to some of the key witnesses, then you're not going to find any evidence.
Going to address that, and you're absolutely right. But they're also describing the evidence for the paedophile ring and then saying, but it's not a paedophile ring. Mm. It is a deliberate attack on common sense and people's cognitive ability to deal with what's going on. It's very, very clever. So let's have a look. How did this whitewash get played out? Well, of course, the inquiry has been dragged on over time. And as the delay has increased, so that has allowed key witnesses such as Nick to be taken off the scene. Many police officers who were involved in him said they believed his evidence. There were some inconsistencies, but we're not going to hear from Nick again because he's got 18 years in prison. And of course, ICSA's not going to present any of his evidence. Key witnesses, this is your point, including abuse survivors and police whistleblowers themselves, denied the opportunity to give evidence. Melanie Shaw, one of the key ones here, she has not been in front of this inquiry, although this inquiry says it has produced the Nottingham Child Abuse Report. That report is out, but of course Melanie's testimony is not part of it. John Wedger, another policeman. There are now a group of police who have come forward and talked about the cover-up of child abuse, including with activity by senior politicians and the Home Office and senior police officers. But those police have not been brought in front of the inquiry. John Wedger, as a significant witness, I believe there's about 60 pages of his evidence. He is not included in this part of Jay's report on Westminster, even though his evidence specifically says that that senior politicians in this day have been covering up the abuse of children.
And of course, there are other survivor groups out there that have refused to take part. It wasn't that they weren't invited, but they actually refused because they understood exactly what type of inquiry this was.
Yes.
They were looking for a proper investigative, judge-led investigative inquiry rather than a cover-up, so they refused to take part.
Indeed. Well, let's carry on. Of course, what was done and is continuing to be done is the division of the inquiry sessions into secret chambers, where we've had the live cameras turned off. We've got the public excluded. Baroness Jay said herself that she was going to have special rules for dealing with the investigation into Westminster, but the reasons for those rules never fully explained to the public. So on it goes. Well, of course, ignoring, thank you, of all of the police investigations around Prime Minister Edward Heath. So we know that very brave senior police officer Mike Veal did that investigation into Edward Heath and said that he believed that had he still been alive, he would have had to answer questions about the abuse of children. This doesn't figure in any of Jay's investigation into Westminster. And she's declared evidence for a protected Westminster political and established paedophile ring, but then describes it as not a ring. This is just incredible. And of course, they then choose an easy scapegoat, which is Lord Steele, to take the blame and distract the media. So the abuse of the children, the suffering of those survivors, just completely dropped from public view whilst everybody starts to feel a little bit sorry for Steele. So we just put her face back on the picture. There was and is no Westminster child abuse ring. We disagree. We say that ring is still in post. It's still exerting power over people trying to come forward and warn about the abuse of children. But we've got to give Baroness Jay credit, because this is a masterpiece of a whitewash, an absolute masterpiece. We've got more to report, and I'll just add that Melanie Shaw would like to thank people who are giving her appropriate, quiet, measured, professional support. She'd like to say thank you very much for that. We'd like to say thank you very much to the lady who has driven over 10,000 miles in the last 18 months to help support Melanie Shaw. Can't report more on that at the moment, but hope to in the coming weeks.
Okay, well, good news, Brian. Boris Johnson is launching a review to define the UK's place in the world. It's called the Integrated Review. This is fusion doctrine in action. And what are they saying about it? A wide range of foreign policy and national security experts inside and outside government will be involved to ensure the UK is equipped to meet the global challenges of the future. And this report will seek new and innovative ways to promote our interests overseas while continuing to commit 2% of GDP to defence, 0.7% of GNI to international development. This integrated review will cover all aspects of the UK's place in the world, from the role of our diplomatic service and approach to development to the capabilities of our armed forces and security services. And it's going to be policy led. It's going to go beyond the parameters of a traditional review by considering the totality of global opportunities and challenges the UK faces, and determining how the whole of government can be structured, equipped and mobilised to meet them. So, Brian, this looks to me like a significant restructuring of just about everything. Foreign policy, defence, security services, whole of government. They're going to look at how they tackle serious and organised crime. They're going to look at how they can better use technology and data to adjust to the changing nature of threats we face, from countering hostile state activity to strengthening armed forces. So that's this so-called grey zone. There is no difference between war and peace attitude. They're going to look very seriously at how the procurement process used by the armed forces and other security services. And they're going to look at an integrated offensive hacking capability. And of course, this is something that they've talked about for a little while, but there's been a big fight between the Ministry of Defence and GCHQ because who's going to be ultimately responsible for that? That's since the previous 2015 review. So here's what Boris had to say. He said, as the world changes, we must move with it. Our integrated review launching today will ensure British foreign policy is rooted firmly in our national interests now and in the decades ahead. He said, I'm determined to lead a government that delivers for our people, both at home and abroad. The UK institutions' expertise, leadership and values are renowned around the world. We cannot rest on our laurels, and we must do more to adapt. I'm feeling very patriotic at this moment, Brian, because Boris just does it for me.
Well, I'm very pleased for you, Mike. Yeah. I'm glad he does it for you, because I think what we've got is one of the most dangerous prime ministers in our history is now in post. He's running a government which is nothing to do with the democracy of this country. And we are now starting to see this government of occupation reveal itself into where it's going. And this is something very dangerous, I think.
Well, indeed. Now, this review is going to report to the Prime Minister directly, it says, and it's going to be supported by a cross-Whitehall team in... Well, now, who is it going to be supported by? Let's have a look. Sir Alex Ellis, he is in charge of it. Now, this is quite interesting because Alex Ellis joined the Department for Exiting the European Union as Director General in January 17. So he is one of the key people responsible for the Theresa May deal. He is one of the key people that was working within the civil service to try to keep us in the European Union. He has extensive experience in the EU, mainly in Brussels, as a member of the cabinet of the President of the European Commission. And in that role, he had responsibility for energy, climate change, competition, development, trade and strategy. And before that, he worked as the UK representation to the EU, particularly on the negotiations to establish the euro, on the seven-year EU budget, and then on institutional issues, including the Treaty of Nice. So this is and looks very much like an EU person, a Remainer, absolutely in charge of the restructuring government. Who will he report to? Well, he's going to report to Mark Sedwill, of course. Mark Sedwill, the head of the National Security Council, and of course, head of the Civil Service and the Cabinet Office. And there's going to be a nice little Cabinet Office team to support Sir Alex Ellis in this operation. So what are they saying? It's going to be a small team in Downing Street as well, but it's going to be comprised of experts from inside and outside the civil service. Departments across Whitehall will input, including the Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, Department for International Development, the Home Office, the Treasury, and the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. And decisions on the review will ultimately be made by the National Security Council, which, of course, has Mark Sedwill as its head. So there we go.
This is a Soviet model, Mike. What we're seeing put together here, in my opinion, is a Soviet, we're going to call it a Soviet, immensely dangerous, because the state is now fully in bed with the security services. You can't divide the two.
Absolutely. Now, another announcement from the UK government today. Good news. Britain is now committing to new nukes. New nuclear warheads. This is good news. But of course, it wasn't such great news for the government, because they've had to announce this today because the US blabbed about it last week. So this is what the Ministry of Defence had to say. They said, our independent nuclear deterrent is essential to defend the UK and our North Atlantic Treaty Organisation allies against the most extreme threats to our national security and way of life. So that's fantastic. So as we said, this was blabbed last week by Admiral Charles Richard, who was speaking to a Senate defence hearing. And he said pre-announced that the UK was going to be doing this. He said this effort will also support a parallel replacement warhead programme in the United Kingdom, whose nuclear deterrent plays an absolutely vital role in NATO's overall defence posture. Well, it isn't going down too well with some opposition parties. Here's Ed Davey, and he had this to say. It's totally unacceptable that the government seems to have given the green light to the development of a new nuclear weapon technology with zero consultation and zero scrutiny. And of course, this is something that we're seeing beyond just defence. The government seems to be plowing ahead with policy without any discussion in Parliament at all.
And it's so clear that MPs are just not involved in the debate on policy. Policy is created off to the sidelines, the Cabinet Office fully involved, but all these other quangos, NGOs and quasi-government departments are producing that policy.
Mm. Mm. Yes. Well, other good news, a new NATO exercise taking place in the Mediterranean involving submarines, Brian. This is Exercise Dynamic Manta, and it involves ships, submarines, aircraft and personnel from 9 NATO countries. France, Greece, Italy and Turkey are supplying submarines for this, and surface ships coming from Canada, France, Greece, Italy, Spain and Turkey. UK not involved because perhaps we don't have any submarines or surface ships in a functional state, I'm not sure, but we are providing aircraft apparently because we are going to support this exercise with maritime patrol aircraft alongside others from Canada, Germany, Turkey and the United States. So there we go. But this is a naval submarine exercise which we're not taking part in.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there's now reports, Mike, that the surface fleet could drop to 15, possibly 9 frigates. So we're talking about the Royal Navy simply disappearing from the scene. So when Boris Johnson is talking about this review, there's something very strange because what's happening doesn't match what you'd think that review, the position that review would take us to. Mm. We'll continue to watch it.
Absolutely. Okay, now if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are options to support us there, and your support much needed and much appreciated. And another reminder of the MH17 awaiting trial public meeting and film screening taking place on Tuesday next week, Tuesday the 3rd of March at 6:30 p.m. Conway Hall in London. Of course, this is discussing the challenges, or at least challenging the EU-NATO version of events around the shooting down of MH17 in 2014. And I'll just mention that a couple of people have asked why we haven't been covering the Julian Assange trial this week. Well, in fact, Patrick Henningsen is there at the moment. And so if you want to get updates on that, do head over to 21st Century Wire. Patrick will be with me on Friday, and this will undoubtedly be discussed there, but on Friday here. But in the meantime, updates on 21st Century Wire.
OK, well, of course, if you're going to have a big review about defence and everything else to do with UK in the background, you're going to be very worried about money. And let's enter with a BBC. Really, it's a fake news story, because is this really news? Or what are we talking about? Well, the headline is Budget 2020. Chancellor must raise taxes in his first budget, says IFS. Well, what's IFS? That's the Institute for Fiscal Studies. So this isn't really an analysis, an article by the BBC. This is an advert by an organisation which calls itself the International Fiscal Studies Fiscal Studies. And what's the meat of it? Well, the Institute suggested that all of the plans the government's got will not be possible without increasing taxes. So there we go. This is how the BBC puts together a created story. It's not about BBC reporting. It's about what the Institute for Fiscal Studies has to say. Well, we took a look at them. We've had a look at them before, but let's remind ourselves. The good news is it's a not-for-profit institution. It's a registered charity, and it's a company limited by a guarantee. So that's all good. And the aims of the Institute laid out in its memorandum and articles are to advance education for the benefit of the public by promoting on a non-political basis the study and discussion of and the exchange and dissemination of information and knowledge concerning the economic and social effects, stay with me, and influences of existing taxes, proposed changes in fiscal systems and other aspects of public policy, in each case, whether in the United Kingdom or elsewhere in the world. So hopefully most people have got all that. It's for the benefit of the public. Please don't forget that. And I know what you wanted to ask, Mike, and of course it's true. It's independent. This is the most important thing to understand. This organisation is independent. So how independent is it? Well, of course, it's very independent. Let's have a look at how that works. Well, from their website, we can have a quick look at the structure of the people running it. We've got a president, we've got an executive committee chair, secretary, executive committee members, council members, on it goes. But the good news is they're all independent. So let's see how that works. Well, here we've got the Executive Committee Chair. He's former Bank of England, former Morgan Stanley, former Treasury Advisor, and he's supported quite nicely by Executive Committee members and Council members who come from the Treasury and the Bank of England itself. So that is all totally independent, of course, of the Bank of England and the Treasury, even though it says it's not, they are independent. And then we bring in a mass of global accountancy firms. So we've got Price Waterhouse, we've got Ernst & Young, we've got a whole range of those. Now, what's the job of those companies? Their job is to run the accounts of global companies so they pay as little tax as possible. But those are also independent people. They must be, because they're working for this independent organisation. And we've got a £1 trillion hedge fund in the middle. Not sure why that's there, but I think they're there for the benefit of the public, right, Mike. Right. So that's good. And what else have we got? Well, we've got regulatory bodies protecting big business from regulation. So that's obviously in the public interest. And then we've got government departments working for transparency and integrity in business. So these are government departments, but not to worry, they're working to protect business interests. And we need to be able to deal with the statistics to show that what everything is happening here is for the benefit of the public. So to have the Office for National Statistics on board, or with a representative at least, is obviously a good idea. And you need lots of press and media coverage to make sure that when you put out a press release, the BBC is going to pick it up and run a major article, even though this is just the opinion from this organisation. So this is how the new style of communitarian government works in UK. And we're just so delighted that we've got charities like this who are independent, protecting the interests of the public. And just to make sure that it's going to look after you, it's also got a representative from the King's Fund. And if you have a look at that, of course, that's an independent health charity that just happens to work with a lot of corporate health companies. So that's all reassuring. So hedge funds mixed into big business, mixed into the Treasury and the Bank of England. Probably appropriate to bring this man up on screen. We talked about the recent review exposing links between the European courts and people who were in the pay of George Soros. Well, we're interested to see that Russia Today has picked up on this and put quite a detailed article up. If you were to go looking on the BBC about this particular topic, well, I could find nothing. So BBC helping to protect George Soros and his work behind the scene, changing society for his best interests, which probably leads us on to an older article, which I think many people have to brace themselves, because it's our old friend Gordon Brown here. This is 2013, but a very good article from the Mirror talking about the Remembrancer. And it was the UK column that first started to talk about this particular individual sitting in Westminster, a representative also sitting in the House of Lords, and his job to work for the corporate interests of the City of London. So this is the gentleman concerned. And the journalist, Ross Wynne-Jones, did a very good article on this. So taking a little bit of that work to show you what was being spoken about. It says, as Elizabeth II takes to the throne in the House of Lords for the Queen's speech today, this is going back to 2013, a little known figure will be taking his special seat close by, all the better to scrutinise every new piece of legislation for how it benefits or damages the banks. He's the only non-MP or civil servant with a seat in the House of Lords and House of Commons. His job dates back to Henry VIII. He's got a budget of 5.3 million, a staff bill of 500,000, a team of six lawyers, and he represents the bankers' interests at the heart of our democracy. So this is reassuring, Mike, isn't it? Alongside the Institute of Fiscal Studies, we've actually got protection for the banks sat in Westminster. More detail, a gentleman called Shaxton, who's written a book called Treasure Island, which is about money in the City of London, says that a previous remembrancer boasted to him that his role was to oppose every bill which would interfere with the rights and privileges enjoyed by the Corporation of London. And Paul Dubble's modern day role is described as looking after the City of London Corporation's interests in Parliament. So Parliament, not really to do with the public, it's to do with making sure we protect the banking interests. There was a bit more, yeah, the job goes back to Henry VIII. And they had a bit of trouble with Henry VIII and his advisor, Cardinal Wolsey, because he was commandeering armour and plate from the livery companies in London. So this is the military industrial complex back in 1571. And so what happened was they created the post of remembrancer to, quote, remind the king of his debt and make sure the city interests were never again affected by Parliament. So people who think that Westminster is there looking after us, of course, a bit mistaken. And this was the overall statement in the article. The shortest explanation for the remembrancer is this: over 1,000 years, kings, queens and governments have been saved by loans from the City of London. In exchange, the City of London has extracted great privileges that still, quote, distort our democracy. So I think we've got to say that the Mirror did a pretty good job here, but many people have forgotten about this power of the banks inside the heart of Western democracy. And we just remind ourselves that, of course, it was Gordon Brown that sold the nation's gold reserves off at a ridiculous amount of money. But here's an article going back to 2009. And it's saying, well, don't worry, we did lose a bit of money, but not really as bad as it could have been. And look on the bright side, we've changed our hand from all that worthless gold into US Treasury securities. And the advantage of those is that they're yielding compound interest. Well, I'm not sure I believe a word of that. This is a fascinating article because the journalist said that he hadn't actually found any evidence for what interest, what extra money had been accrued from those Treasury, the US Treasury notes. But he was sure that we had done okay. Mm. So there we are.
Okay, now, more good news, Brian. It doesn't get any better than this. Ofcom has decided that 5G technology is completely safe. We don't have to worry about it at all. Ofcom, of course, is the regulator for the media in the UK, but it's also the regulator for the telecommunications industry. And it's now released its first results of safety tests of 5G infrastructure in the UK. And as I say, the news is it's all good. They found that radiation levels are at tiny fractions of safe limits. So just so that everybody understands exactly where we're coming from here, this is a quote from the document that or the press release that Ofcom put out alongside this, because they ask, what is Ofcom's role with respect to 5G? And what they say is, we're working with the government and industry to help the UK become a world leader in 5G. So my question to you, Brian, is how does a regulator do that? Is that not a conflict of interest?
Well, it's direct conflict of interest, Mike, but we're having a good look at Ofcom at the moment because, of course, one of their dubious relationships is directly with the BBC. And what we're seeing is that in meetings where Ofcom discusses issues to do with BBC performance and development and the growth of the BBC, you can have as many as 7 out of 10 of the people present are themselves ex-BBC, many of them on BBC pensions. So Ofcom, extremely interesting organisation, and I think the public need to really be digging into it.
Okay, so let's dig into this a little bit. So this is one example of the document that documentation that they've released on this. So have a look at that. Mobile bands covered by this report, so from 700 megahertz up to 3.8 gigahertz, plus others. And when you look at the definition of others, that includes all other frequencies between 420 megahertz and 6 gigahertz. So the maximum frequency we're looking at here is 6 gigahertz. And if we look at one set of results, this is from Liverpool, This is location one in Liverpool. They give the coordinates there and the measurement time, and they show the percentage by comparison to the reference levels, the international reference levels for public exposure. And so they're saying that the total exposure that they detected was 0.0386% of the international reference levels. So that's fantastic. That seems very safe, doesn't it? But here's the thing. If we actually look at what 5G is, we're looking at really three sets of frequency bands. Coverage, what they describe as coverage, this is sub 1 gigahertz. Actually, in the UK, that's going to be 700 megahertz. And we should point out that Ofcom isn't auctioning this frequency range until later this year. I think in May that auction will be complete. So this frequency range isn't being used for 5G at the moment. So this is called the coverage layer. It provides wide area and deep indoor coverage. And in Europe, it's the 700 megahertz band. Then we come to the capacity, coverage and capacity layer. This is 1 gigahertz to 6 gigahertz. Regulators have identified 3.4 to 3.8. This is European regulators, 3.4 to 3.8 gigahertz band for this. And then finally, we have the super data layer, which is 26 gigahertz. And this is so-called millimeter wavelengths. And this is really the area that all the 5G campaigners at the moment are expressing the most concern about, because millimeter waves are the most damaging potentially. And so this is above 6 gigahertz. But in the UK, it's going to be somewhere between 24.25 and 25.5 gigahertz band. Okay, so if we think back to what we saw from Ofcom's report a few seconds ago, they were only talking about the range from 450 megahertz up to 6 gigahertz. So we're not even talking about 5G in the ultimate destination, which because if we're talking about the this range here, this is really an enhancement of 4G. We might call it 4.5G. It's really proper 5G, because it's only once we get the millimeter wave transmissions that we start getting proper 5G speeds, as are being promised to us. And that's in this area around the 26 gigahertz, as is described. So as I say, we're really looking at 4.5G at this point. Before we get onto this BBC article, Brian, my point here is, what are we looking at? We're looking at a report from Ofcom saying it's all safe. We're looking at a frequency range which is really an enhancement of 4G. They're calling it 5G for marketing purposes. And of course, that also allows them then to claim that it's no less safe. They don't say it's safe, but they're able to claim that it's no less safe than 4G. And therefore, it instills in people's minds, in the public's minds, that 5G is safe, when in fact the main 5G technology developments haven't even been rolled out yet.
So you've got the public are being deliberately deceived, and then this is being used as a thin end of the wedge to help the marketing of 5G. That's what's going
that's
on,
what
I think.
That's what it seems to be to me. So here's the BBC's coverage of this from yesterday. UK's 5G network well within safety limits at Ofcom test find. And in their coverage of it, they brought up Rory Cathlin-Jones, mouthpiece for the industry, I have to say. Well done to the Working Together to Keep Devon 5G Free group, because he has picked on them as being an example of the sort of detractors, the deniers that he wants to highlight, because apparently he claims they're peddling conspiracy theories. Well, this is not the case. And really, Rory Cathlin-Jones, if he was doing his job, would be asking the questions about what exactly was the technology that was being tested by Ofcom, and really raising the questions about, how does that develop in the future?
Yeah, well, what he's done there is the smear story. We've shown the BBC non-story over child abuse, but then what we've got there is the smear. So he doesn't go for the information that the 5G groups are putting forward in order to see how they're warning about the dangers of 5G. You smear them. And notice he brings in the coronavirus. If you heard the BBC last night trying to create even more out of that story. There's a lot more to be reported, which we are going to cover. But now he conflates the 5G one in with that. He doesn't go through it in a logical sequence. But I wonder whether he'll be concerned as the 5G mast goes up in the BBC site in Plymouth. That's in Seymour Road, where we understand that is going to be one of the most powerful 5G transmitters. I hope he will be happy to explain to his BBC work colleagues that their health and safety is going to be put at risk due to the fact that the BBC can't do any proper investigation.
And so the question is, what is Ofcom's attitude to EMF safety, the electromagnetic frequency safety, and in the 5G world? Mainstream media, the BBC, says that Ofcom's very happy with it, that it's all good. But are they absolutely 100% comfortable with it? Because alongside this this documentation that they've released about measurements that they took on one particular day, and by the way, if you measure on a different day, you may get different results, and if you use different equipment, you may get different results, and maybe the providers would be using a different power setting on the day that you go to measure rather as opposed to the day they measure. But nonetheless, they have launched this consultation, proposed measures to require compliance with international guidelines for limiting exposure to electromagnetic fields. And they're saying, we're proposing to include a specific condition in Wireless Telegraphy Act licenses requiring licensees to comply with the relevant levels from the ICNIRP guidelines. This condition would apply to all equipment which can transmit powers above at powers above 10 watts, including, for example, the licenses of mobile phone companies, TV and radio broadcasters, and point-to-point microwave links. So they say that in all cases, including recent measurements near 5G-enabled base stations, we've recorded measurements well within the levels of general public exposure from the guidelines. In fact, the highest level measured was approximately 1.5% of the levels identified in the guidelines. And so my question then is, why is there a need to consult? If everything is at such a low level compared to the international limits, why is there a need to consult on this? Surely at 1%, 1.5% of what the international limits are, there's so much headroom in that that there's no need for a consultation. Or is it that there's a recognition in Ofcom that actually it's the next level of 5G technology that's coming out which might cause the problem? Because at millimeter wavelengths, of course, they need many, many more transmitters. And those are very localized and very close to the people using the handsets.
It's interesting one to think about. My view is that the consultation process itself is part of the scam. They have to give the impression that they are protecting the public, working to protect the public. So they have to be seen to go through motions. But what we know they're not doing is going through the proper motions in the proper detail, looking at the right information. Mm. But this is part of the scam. The other interesting thing is all the names that I looked at connected with Ofcom over the last few days, where we're having a really good look at what Ofcom is and who's involved with it. There's no technical expertise on that list of individuals at all. They're all production media people. So when Ofcom says this is our advice, I think we're going to have a really good look at where that advice is coming from and who's putting it together.
Yep.
Well, that brings us to the end of our news today. I'm going to say thank you very much for the person who sent us some books. We are going to say very interesting. They're to do with Israel and to do with matters about the Merchant Navy. Very kind of you to send in those books. We're gently going to say, though, we can only take a certain amount of material like books because we've got a lot of material here at UK Column that people have kindly sent us, and we can only cope with so much of it. So thank you for the thought, but sometimes material can be a little bit tricky for us to store. What else can we say? I'll just leave people to reflect on the ICSA report, and that whilst ICSA takes place, many of the abuse victims have never been called forward. They've been denied the opportunity to speak. And of course, what has ICSA ultimately done? It has produced a report which protects the very Westminster system, which has closed down abuse of children by people in positions of power. democracy? I don't think so. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.